My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. The word warrior accurately describes our next guest. She followed in her father's footsteps and at the age of 16, joined the British Army. After serving in some of the most hostile environments on the planet, she now faces her hardest battle, her battle with cancer. Episode 28, Mandy Islam. This is Declassified. Mandy, what was childhood like growing up? Because your dad was in the military.
It was really great fun. I mean, we lived in Germany for 6 years, so it was a really great social culture. And I think just going to the local pub on a Friday afternoon, the Pig and Stick, and everyone that would be there in uniform, and all the kids would be running around foraging in the woods for wild strawberries. And it was just absolutely brilliant. It was what I think everyone imagines childhood to be like, a bit Famous Five, but with the fun of the service life included.
There's so much positive, especially from the kids. I know our community's been going away a lot recently, and they always have, but that unity of it, especially the with the kids growing up. Was you always with the same group of friends?
No, so we moved every 2 or 3 years. Dad was bomb disposal in the RLC. So we had times when we had, Dad there, and there times where we just simply wouldn't see him, and then times where you didn't know if you were going to see him again. So it was a really strange place to be, and you kind of accepted it as a child, because if Daddy didn't come back, it would kind of be okay. But I think it's because you didn't actually understand what Daddy not coming back actually meant.
And where did he used to go away? Northern Ireland?
He spent a lot of time in Northern Ireland, yes.
Yeah. I bet he's got some stories to tell.
Absolutely, offer him a dram and you might get one.
Get him on. Childhood and that service life didn't discourage you from joining. So you joined 97, joined the Remi.
That's right. I mean, I wanted to be, my father, basically. He was my hero in so many levels, a guy who would put his life before somebody else's. Walk up to what was going to be a bomb or a device and defuse it, and not always with a robot. Some of them he had to do by hand with the toolkits. So he's a remarkable guy. He did the M6 job, I think it was back in 97-ish. Where he climbed scaffolding under the bridge in Birmingham and defused it in a set of Combat 95 in a handheld toolkit at height. So he's done some really incredible things.
Probably your dad.
Oh, absolutely. Even now he's still my legend. I'll do anything for him.
Really?
Anything, yeah.
So why the Remi?
Well, I actually wanted to be a vehicle mechanic. I always liked tinkering with cars, and one of the first things I learnt to do as a child, really, was change the brakes, shoes and pads on a car. Again, probably because it's something that I did with my father. So I wasn't one for dollies or learning to cook or do girl stuff, and I'm still pretty rubbish at all the girl stuff now. But I was up for climbing trees, foraging and mending things, and I think that's just because I leaned more naturally into my father's
side. Your
dad
was the role model, really.
Absolutely.
Amazing. I mean, you've had a real interesting career as such, and we're not going to focus too much on that today, but you then left the Remi and joined the intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do that?
Again, my dad suggested it would be a good idea. So I took him up on it, not actually knowing much about it, and it was hilarious because it was my first ever drive after passing my car test. So I was several hours late. I bounced off curbs. The alloys on the hire car were trashed by the time I got there, and I was exhausted. But I obviously made some sort of impression and got in. So it was good.
Did you deploy with those guys?
Where'd you go? It's the best 10 years of my life. So I think the ones that stand out for me, apart from Northern Ireland and Bosnia, would be Iraq. Twice, so 2003 up in Alamara, and then 2005-06 in Badger Palace. But Alamara was just insane.
When was that? 2003. Was it during what Telic was it?
So just as Telic 1 was finishing, so just as war fighting phase finished, so I went out there in July and went straight onto the Mazar-e Kabir case, really.
Yeah,
so.
okay, Yeah, yeah.
And some then, really interesting stuff.
Baz Rapali's the next tour.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not going to go into it too much because you're still serving, and we're not going to venture into that side of things. I'm not going to push you into it. But after that, you went for your commission.
That's right. I kind of got bullied into it, would you believe it? I didn't think I was commissioning material, but other people did. And I almost thought after, I think particularly 2003, where it was a pretty tasty tour, and I was treated as a rifleman, which was absolutely incredible. So I was out on the ground all the time, either hang out with the back of a helicopter, having some interesting exchanges with people who weren't so friendly. And I think getting to actually be a soldier and do the soldiering role was phenomenal, and particularly at a time when you didn't have many ladies doing roles like that. And I think because I had quite a close relationship with the officers, because they allowed me to do all those things, I also got to see a different side of the army. So I was kind of half in the soldier cadre, half in the officer cadre. And I think I quite enjoyed seeing some of the best people who are currently still serving the British Army today working in such a stressful and operational environment, you know. And again, one of my my role models, a chap, Brigadier Tom Bjerk, still serving, you know, phenomenal, coming in off the ground and seeing that guy work in an ops room when things were going a little bit crazy in Alamara, you know, was such a big inspiration. And I thought, if I could be a quarter of the person that man is today, you know, then I would have justified my existence. So that kind of tipped me over into that area.
Yeah. And then how does it work then when you go for a commission? Because then you joined the RMP after that.
Yeah.
Well, why does that work? Why didn't you go back to intelligence? What was the...
Because I was told some fibs, basically. So a chap who will remain nameless basically said, you know, come, Mandy, come and do this. You can do all these great things and you'll really enjoy it. And being a little bit naive, despite already serving, I said, yes, that sounds wonderful. But I realised very quickly it wasn't for me. I wanted to spend more time, without being too controversial, leading soldiers, whereas a troop commander spent a lot of time looking at casework, which you can completely agree with as a police officer. That's what you're there to do. But for me, I wanted to take my bloke surfing. I wanted to spend time with them and get them prepared for operations and, you know, really focus on them as people.
Mm. How long did you do with the RMP?
Oh, I don't know, maybe just over a year.
Oh, okay, so not long at all.
No.
And then went to REMC. So
that's right, yeah.
And what was the change then? What did you feel? Did you feel different when you joined, or you recap badged?
Well, like I said, I knew within 4 days that the RMP wasn't for me, so it was a pretty easy decision. But the mess that we shared at the time was also with the medics. They just got back from ops in Afghan. And they were so motivated, so outgoing, had so many great stories of making a difference for looking after our boys and girls in operations, looking after the medics that they supported as well, or supported them. And then also what they were doing out on the ground to support civilians. Mm. So not only those who had sadly been part of a conflict, but those who didn't have a medical facility that they could go to. So they were picking up the primary healthcare requirement because it wasn't there at the time in Afghanistan. And to hear so much great work being done was inspirational. And I just thought, again, if I could perhaps improve or help somebody do their job as a medic or as a doctor, a member of the medical services, then I'd be halfway to being a reasonable human being. So it was just, I wanted to make a difference. And I thought they were so worthy of leading, and if I had the privilege to lead them, then brilliant.
We've had a couple of medical guys on here, medics, and their stories are amazing. I've become close friends with one of them especially, and it's just that neat. And he carries a medical kit around with him everywhere he goes. Medical kit. It's just there's this inbuilt need to be able to help other people, and whether that's in brackets, the enemy, or whether it's our own troops. It's an amazing thing. And you're still cap badged with them now?
That's right, yes.
Did you deploy? Have you deployed in that role?
Twice to Afghanistan.
Really?
So I'm a medical support officer by trade, so I'm not a clinician. So it's very different. It's great. And to have your guys come off the ground and come in to see you and just to offload what they've done, what they've seen, like I say, and is a real privilege to be there to lead people who deal with some of the most appalling circumstances. It is the greatest privilege you could have as an officer in the army.
Explain what your role is, let's say in Afghanistan, because we can talk about the role, you know, and it's in some amazing work that we do. What did you actually do on?
So on my first tour, I was with 16 Brigade, and I was just a company 2IT, so squadron 2IT. But all of my guys were out on the ground basically doing frontline medicing at the time, and some of them were on the MERT as well. But they were just doing incredible things. And then the second tour, I was the ops officer for the hospital as well as the medical regiment at the time, so it's quite a big undertaking.
Yeah.
So
what years were that?
I'm rubbish with dates, I'm afraid. I can only remember operational tours.
Oh, yeah, what tours then? What tours?
So 13 and 17.
Yeah, yeah, so 13 especially, still, you know, in the real thick of it.
Yeah, 13 was, you know, things were still going on. It was eye-opening because it was your friend. As a brigade, 16 brigade, you really bonded with those people who you were supporting. So not only your own medical regiment, but with the parage that you were supporting. So I was the LO to 3 para for a wee bit, and also stepped into LO for 2 para when their LO wasn't available. So you got to work with the different battalions, and you became really close friends. You know, you worked together, you played together.
Yeah.
It was an incredible experience, and particularly when you saw the blokes coming off the ground, they knew that they could go and talk to you. It doesn't make a difference you're an officer or not in their chain of command. They just knew that you were available to just sit down, have a brew with, and just offload what was going on.
Well, and were guys offloading?
Yeah.
In theatre still?
Yeah.
And what kind of, like, with regards to conflict and trauma?
Yeah.
Or was it things at home? What was the kind of feeling?
It was moreover just wanting to, whatever was going on in their minds at that point in time. Sadly, we had a couple of deaths on that tour, and when people are up close and personal with those deaths as well, that's quite traumatic, and they just want to, like I say, offload to somebody because they know it's not going to go anywhere. They know they're not going to be judged, and you might have some words that might be of some use, but ultimately, you know, I see it very much as being part of the role of, you know, as cliched as it is, serving to lead, because at the end of the day, it's my job as an officer to make the blokes' lives as easy as possible. And my superiors as well at the end of the day, because, you know, it was up to some commanding officers actually would come and just say, do you want to have a hot chocolate? And just actually just let things go.
The pressure of leadership as well is can be so great. Sometimes we forget about that, you know, from afar, leading people and sending people to places, and especially in places like Afghan, so traumatic and so chaotic in certain respects as well. Did you grow because of Afghanistan? Did you become a better person because of your experiences?
When I was on Herrick 13, I learned so much about the value of the military family, because it really is quite a close-knit group of people. And I still keep in contact with a number of those people today, you know, and that's a real privilege. There's also a bit, I think, where maybe as a young trooper or as a young captain, you're a bit arrogant. So you walk the walk and you kind of do what you think you should be doing to fit into your ecosphere, the environment that is. And obviously 16 Brigade is a very proud environment, a very capable, incredibly capable environment. So that's what's closest to the canoe. In terms of growth, I think it's actually the cancer bit that really made me grow as a person, because it stripped me away of my identity, and then I had to rebuild myself off the back of that. So I learned a huge amount from that, actually.
Let's take us there then. So you was out running with your dog. When was that? 2015.
yeah.
You take us from there then. You went out for a normal run.
Yeah, so I got Sir Frederick, my little monkey poo, who's a French bulldog. And I didn't want him to just be a portly apartment dog. I wanted him to actually be capable of enjoying a happy physical life. And we were doing a fartlek session between lampposts, and he just stopped and looked at me as if to say, "Mummy, do I have to?" And I put my foot down to the side to avoid wearing him as a slipper, basically, because he was exactly where my footfall was. And I felt some sort of contact, but it wasn't a snapping or a bang or any noises or anything like that, no twists. And I kind of carried on running and carried on ignoring it for as long as I could, basically. I moved 7 tons of soil and gravel, doing a garden project. Sadly, I couldn't carry my sister's coffin when she died because it was so painful. And then just got to a point where I just went, okay, enough is enough. And that was, I think, four months down track.
So from initially hurting your foot and then going through everything with your sister and just living with a pain, still local in your foot?
So it was in the knee area.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was in the knee area.
Yeah. And then what? What did you do? What was the, you having a pain in your knee?
Mm.
Did you initially just go and to get it checked out as a knee injury?
So I literally, you know, I did all the things that you try and do, you know, ice, compression, a little brufen, elevation. And then I just went to the doc and just said, look, doc, you know, literally my leg won't work. Can you do something? And it was hot and it was red and it was, you know, painful to touch. So he organised a scan for me. And when I went for the scan, the people who were looking at it said to me, you know, what have you done to your leg? So I knew there was something going on off the back of it, but they wouldn't tell me anything more. And then I was referred to an orthopod because it was a bony type injury, we thought at that point. Mm. And he was really, really cagey in his language. He wouldn't say anything that I could understand despite asking him to put it in different ways. So I asked him for a copy of my notes and a copy of my images and went to the car, hobbled to the car, basically, opened them up and called a friend of mine who's an orthopaedic surgeon and just said, look, you know, Scotty, what do these words mean? And he said to me, are you allowed to swear on this?
Yeah.
Okay, he just basically went, shit, Mandy, that's cancer. And I went, oh, mega. He goes, why? Whose notes are you reading? And I said, mine. And he was like, "That, where are you?" And I said, I'm in the car park of the general hospital. And, you know, so he went into kind of the welfare side of it. And being a singly, I just had nothing to do apart from go to the block and mull it over as to what was going on. I went in with a leg pain and now I've probably got cancer and being code redded to a different hospital.
Why didn't the doctor tell you?
I think because he wasn't entirely sure himself. It had to be properly investigated, so yeah. Biopsies and stuff like that. But not many people actually see conditions like multiple myeloma, and that presents in many different ways. So whilst multiple myeloma is a blood cancer, basically one of the plasma cells has gone wonky, it can affect people or it can show in breaks and fractures in the bones, normally in the spine or ribs, but for me it presented in my leg.
Oh, we're not there yet. So when did you get the official kind of, is it diagnosis, prognosis?
Yeah. So the diagnosis came in May, and I'd already prepared myself for it because I had the phone call with Scotty, so I knew broadly that I had cancer. But I didn't know which type of cancer, and I was given an option of two, but they couldn't tell me which two it was. One was curable, one wasn't curable. Yeah. So they asked me to choose my hospital, and I chose my hospital based on the non-curable cancer, so the worst-case scenario, basically, which turned out to be right. So in July, by the time I got there, sat in front of my professor, had the interview, you know, about, you know, what was going on and to consent to chemotherapy, and I left and went to go and get my drugs from the pharmacist, and I just said to my specialist nurse, you know, am I going to die? And he said, that's one for the professor. And I said, okay, when am I going to die? And he said, that was one for the professor too. So he organised for us to go back in as soon as she finished clinic that afternoon. I went in, I just said to her, you know, am I going to die? And she said, yes. And I said, when? She goes, well, 2 to 3 years at worst, 7 years at best. And then I just went, okay, thanks very much, and took myself to Charlotte Street, and my friend and I cracked open a bottle of Fizz and just chewed it over. So it was quite an interesting moment to go from, you know, knocking your leg to avoid stepping on your dog to actually finding out you've got something that's going to kill you.
When did you tell your dad?
That's a really good question, actually. What I did for that is I had rehearsed what I was going to say. So in the car the next day, I'd rehearsed all the way driving down to Somerset what I was going to say, because I didn't want to instill fear or panic. I didn't want to make anyone feel as if they didn't have any control, and I didn't want them to feel like we weren't going to do something proactive or positive about it. So once I got my head around what that all looked like, he opened the door and he knew something was wrong. He knew something was wrong. He said, "You know, what is it, chum?" as he calls me, and I said, "You know, Dad, is that leg pain isn't good news. You know, it's cancer." So he was devastated. Devastated.
How did he react? That initial
tears, as you'd expect. And there's been a lot of them since, because how does a father deal with his little girl dying? It's not there for. It's not, I don't think, within any parent particularly, wished to be putting your child in the ground. And particularly as my other sister, Mo, had passed a couple of months before I was diagnosed, they'd already had quite a run of it.
No, it must be horrendous.
Yeah.
And your attitude has not been horrendous, and it's been from afar inspiring, and we'll get to that shortly. What was next in this kind of journey? Where do we go from there? Where do we go from that initial? What is it called? So when you get told exactly what it is that diagnosis?
So, yeah, diagnosis when you're told what it is, and prognosis is what's going to likely to happen, the outcome from it all.
So we've had prognosis now, have we?
Yeah.
And then what's the next?
So I went into treatment. The drugs that are used, Velcade, thalidomide and dexamethasone, which is steroid, the first month went relatively well. I was, super small by that time. I think I got lost weight to about 54 kilos. So about 10, 11 kilos I'd lost by that point. By the second month...
Sorry, is that because of the medication?
Because of cancer.
That's just because of the
cancer, yeah.
Right, okay.
I rapidly lost a lot of weight. And then by the second month, I just couldn't stop eating, and it was all sweets. I just needed to feed myself. So I was putting on loads of weight, and then the steroids as well. So I was then bursting out of my clothes.
Yeah.
And then by the third month, I think the concoction of drugs really started to I would say, mess up my mind. They call it chemo brain. But... I'd sometimes lose the ability to speak. Sometimes my vision would go. Sometimes I just couldn't function as a human being. I'd take Freddie for a walk and I'd be on crutches, and that's about as much as I could do. I couldn't drive anymore. I couldn't work. I lost all my confidence, my value, my purpose, my identity. I was stripped of everything as a human being. And it was the first time I'd ever... been stripped of myself, and it was the first time that I'd ever had to deal with what some people call black dog days, mental health, because I was always glasses absolutely toppers and running around at Mac 10 going to the next party or working my socks off in between, and then all of a sudden I just had nothing.
Is that because it was the vulnerability of it all, and was it the stark realization of what was it going to happen? What was the, was it a mix of everything?
I was never worried about dying. I'm still not worried about dying yet. It was just the effect of all the drugs that I was taking.
Yeah.
Because you just can't make sense of it all. Your brain's functioning and the next minute it's not. Your blood's itching and you want to rip your body apart. Your body, 1 minute you're constipated and the next minute you can't walk 5 metres without going to the loo. It's a really
How were the drugs administered? How are you receiving the drugs, and is it daily? How does it work?
So at that time, during that regime, it was every week in hospital for an injection that was administered by the hospital, and then the thalidomide and the dexamethasone at home, just in tablet form.
So,
and then administering your own things like blood thinners as injections as well. So we literally rattled. My drawer on the side of the bed was just stacked full of medication.
Yeah. And then with regards to kind of... poor mental health as well as good mental health, how did you have support through that period of time? Not just friends, but did you have professional assistance?
No, not at all. And this is the really strange thing about it. When people are diagnosed, they are going to, and from my, you know, my research since, and from meeting a lot of people who have experience of cancer or other life-changing or life-limiting conditions, they will go through a period of adjustment, but no one's prepared for it because nobody tells you.
Yeah.
And then when doctors tend to tell you about side effects when you consent for medication, it tend to be a very lean description of what that actually means. So, you know, they say we might be constipated. Well, we're talking about doing bathroom gymnastics for a rabbit poo. You know what I mean? It's just, it's not like constipation, you know. It's not like diarrhea that you know about when you're, you know, shitting out the inside of your gastro tract. Yeah. You know, luminous green water, basically. It's such an extreme.
Yeah.
It's not a nice place to be. So I think part of it is the fact that people don't tell you what you're going to experience. The second part is you have to get the balance right for medications to help you. So I think I went through 5 different types of anti-sickness tablets before I got to one that actually worked. Friends were absolutely incredible. That, you know, they absolutely kept me going. We used to have picnics every week and make a real fun time out of chemotherapy. But what they didn't see is a couple of days afterwards when I was, you know, a bit more on my chin strap. And then when it came to my parents, because I had to move back home for a while, I didn't want to burden them with what I was going through because, like I say, my sister had passed so recently and they were looking down the barrel of a gun of another one going. So I didn't want to worry them with what was going on with me. So I kept it inside, actually, quite a lot. And
yeah.
Actually, I started writing my book then, I think probably in part to capture all of these experiences because it was good to get it out somewhere. It was a way of talking about it without actually having to have a conversation and without having to trouble anyone with what I was going through.
Yeah, some almost self-medication, but in a very therapeutic way by writing. Was it therapy for you?
I didn't actually see it as therapy. It was a case of having a conversation without being able to trouble somebody.
Yeah.
You know, for me, if I was to say something was therapeutic, that would be, you know, taking a car out for a spin or a boat out for a spin or something like that, or going in on the hills. I like that type of, that for me is more therapy.
Offload.
Yeah, because you can just disconnect from everything. Whereas when you're on this journey, the thing that's trying to kill you is with you 24/7. It's in your body. You know, you can't shoot it, you can't bayonet it, you can't strangle it.
Yeah.
It's something you've got to love as much as your healthy cells and try and support the rest of your body whilst this thing is trying to kill all the good work that you're doing. It's a, it's an interesting one.
We talked about, because we're near Tottenham Court Road now, we talked about something just before we started recording. And can you kind of talk us through that again?
Yeah, so it was just before I went into stem cell transplant, which was a really big event for me. That was my Everest. So my cancer journey, for the first part of it, I'd model it against Everest. I went up the South Col route, so the various camps with various treatment regimes that I had to undertake. So my Everest was the following day, or summit day was the following day. And I remember being sat in the cinema watching Bond, and my body just shut down on me. It just said, I've had enough, and I couldn't remember how to breathe. It was a really strange experience. One minute I was breathing, the next minute I physically wasn't breathing, and I had to talk my organs almost into breathing. You know, you've got to breathe in through your mouth, lungs you need to inflate, you need to breathe out, you need to keep doing it. And when I came out of that, it really hit me that I think my mental health had enough. It said, look, you can only soldier on through so much. You've got to get this out and get some sort of professional help, as you said. And that's when I booked into hospital the next day and said, I need to talk to someone professionally because this is what's happened. And I think my body has said, enough is enough. We need to do something about this.
And you believe that was totally psychological? That the shutting down, like not the shutting down, but the inability to go keep breathing?
I can't explain it, it just happened. But I think it was because you crack on and you just do the best you can. And because I wasn't really sharing this a great deal, I was internalizing a lot of stress all the time. And I think basically my body, and probably there's someone out there who can tell you the medicalized view on all of this, but I think basically my body just said, your mind can't tell you to keep on doing this anymore. I'm doing something about it for you. I think it's what happened.
Amazing. And then post that, we then went for help.
Yeah, it was hilarious because he said I was the wellest patient he had. So it wasn't very helpful at all. It was helpful in the way, I mean, it was only a counsellor, the hospital, and it's really great the hospital's got a counselling facility and they could get you in quite so quickly. But it was just a case of I said stuff, he listened, and then said, great, well, you're the wellest person I have, so do you want to see me again or not? It was odd.
But then did you pursue kind of mental health intervention? Did that
no.
carry on? Was that it?
Yeah.
That's an incredible. That doesn't say. It just seems baffling to say someone's you're the wellest person I've got.
I know. But I think that for that comment for me just shows a bigger issue when it comes to life changing, life limiting conditions such as cancer, because there isn't the facilities for people who are going to go through this process, which we know is going to be very traumatic, which we know is going to be up and down, and it's not a smooth ride. So nationally, there's a bigger problem in my view because facilities simply don't exist.
Hmm. Stem cell transplant, you said it was going to be such a big deal.
Mm.
What was it? What did it entail? What was it? And why was it being kind of implemented? Why was this? Because we'd already gone through chemo.
Yeah, so I did the four cycles of Velcade, thalidomide and Dex, and then two intensive chemotherapy sessions, which is 5 days at a time, 24 hours a day. So you're hooked up to a drip that sleeps with you, that showers with you. Injection once a week, 3-4 bags of chemotherapy put into you every day on top of the IV drip that's going 24 hours a day. So I did two of those as well. And that's when my hair fell out. So that was pretty toxic on the old body.
That was 2016?
Yep, so Jan 2016. And it took me about, I think, a year for my body to get back to normal after that. It was really quite traumatic. But for me, psychologically, I summited Everest, therefore I was on top of the world. And I knew that getting down the mountain is the hardest part of the journey. So I prepared myself for the fact that I had to get back down the mountain safely as well. So I was pretty much, you know, set up for whatever that looked like. And I was just delighted to have got to the top of Everest. And I was delighted to be making my way down. And for me, making sure I got off the mountain was getting back into work and starting to build up what life looked like before.
Yeah. And stem cell transplant, what was that what you just mentioned there? Or was that just purely chemotherapy, what you just mentioned?
So with a stem cell transplant, they give you a big dose of chemotherapy, say a high dose of melphalan. And basically that just burns you inside out. So on that, you're kind of like sucking ice lollies or ice cubes to try and stop the burns and bleeding in your mouth.
Oh.
And then it just burns you right through to your bottom. So I couldn't control my bowels properly for about a year. It's really, really hard going. Really hard going.
Does it ever feel like you just want to end that? That just sounds horrific. Not suicide, I'm not saying that, but what I mean is just like, this is enough now.
That's how I felt going into my second transplant. And I've only just had that in February this year, so it's just, a month and a half?
Yeah.
And I remember getting ready for the transplant psychologically. I started to prepare myself for it because I knew it was traumatic. And, you know, for military listeners, I'd say it's like going out on patrol, but you haven't got the fire team, you haven't got anyone in depth in support, don't have any overhead, you haven't got any fire support, but you know you're going to get blown up. You know, I don't mean that to dismiss anyone who has been blown up, but you know you're going to get hit by something.
Yeah.
You know it's going to hurt, but you don't know how badly you're going to be hit. You don't know when the medical response is going to be there. You don't know what the recovery journey is going to look like on the other end. So that was really, really hard going, because I had to make peace and be comfortable with the fact that I was going to put myself through that again.
And that was just now, but the first one was two years ago.
Mm.
And in between that, what was life like?
Yeah, so I got into powerboat racing. I wanted to really test I wanted to test myself, because I'd been through so much trauma. So I wanted to do something that was, I suppose, a little bit extreme, because I'd lost Mandy Islam. You know, I didn't exist anymore. I'd been stripped of everything that was important to me. You know, less my friends and my family, but I didn't have an identity, and I had to build that identity up from scratch. So for me, what did I have? Yes, I'm in the army. I've been in the army since I was 16 years old, and that's something I hold incredibly dear. What was my purpose? To do my job well and look after the men and women of the armed forces. Could I go back and do that? Absolutely. And then what could I do for me as a human being? I needed to have other interests that wouldn't mean that I just lived to work, and therefore power boating was the outcome of that. So when I'm well enough, I need to start getting back in the gym and building up strength again, but hoping to do a few world records and a nice 40-foot power boat, which is a little bit extreme.
Has the military supported you through that? Or is it charities, or is it just self-funded? How do you do it?
So I have the guy who owns the boat is a bit of a philanthropist, and also works in the disability space. So we're both very passionate about that. And the whole purpose behind doing the record attempt is to raise awareness for life-limiting, life-changing conditions, to show people who are in these situations that life doesn't need to finish or end just because you have a diagnosis or a prognosis. To show to people who think that disability is simply somebody in a wheelchair that it's far more complex, and it's far more of it in society than you'd know. And I thought, by being someone who wore uniform, be that, you know, a British Army uniform or someone who wears a race suit, it was a really good way to do that in a 120 mile an hour billboard, basically. So, for me, if I can support people and other people, support them in their life journeys, and for those people who aren't so aware of what disability looks like, then again, like I say, I've done my job. It's important.
Yeah. Well, what does disability look like?
It's everywhere. It's everyone. Everybody has something that's going on at some point in time. And whilst there's a legal definition of disability, I think it's easier to look at something that, is a physical or a mental impairment that affects people to conduct their normal life business.
Mm. And psychologically, how has it affected you now? Because, let's say we're still in 2016 for the purpose of this recording. How, at that point, were you feeling psychologically? How were you coping with it? How far away in the future were you looking? You said you were coming down the back end of Everest. Had you felt you'd achieved?
Oh, gosh, yes. I was absolutely delighted, cloud nine. I was so proud of myself, so proud of my body, for what it had managed to take me through. The challenge was getting back into normal, and what other people viewed of me. So when I had no hair, for example, it was really easy for people to go, oh, okay, as a visual cue, there's something going on there. But when my hair came back, it was like weapons free, and people just treated me like a normal human being. And normal is good to a point, but when you're still unpacking the trauma of what you've been through, and your body's still not playing ball, and you're trying to run at the same speed as everybody else in a very demanding work environment, for example, that has a lot of challenges.
Mm. And we mentioned work a second ago, but at this point, 16, 17, and most of 18, were work being supportive? Were they adapting to what was happening to you? As in your boss, your direct boss, were they, and the work you were conducting? When did you go back to work? There's a lot of questions there. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just throwing loads at you.
No, it's fine. I went to work very soon, actually, after my condition. I think I had June to the first-ish of March away from work. And in that time, I also did a month of fertility treatment, which is a really grim experience as well, to be fair. And then the chemotherapy, then the intensive chemotherapy, then the stem cell transplant. You generally take about 6 months to come back to work after a stem cell transplant. Mm. And I was back in after two. Because my motivation, that bit about finding your value and purpose, identity, I'm so military, I suppose, in some ways, that I needed to get back into that to feel like a human being again. Mm. In terms of employers, it's a real tough one for them because they don't know what they don't know. So they will have commitments, competing priorities and things to do. And if you're not running at the same speed, then I suppose, you know, one might view them as being a slightly weaker link in that chain. And that's quite hard, I think, for managers, particularly when they're constantly having demands put upon them. But as a human being and as a soldier, you know, there's a point where the human has to come first before the soldier. So you can actually learn to be yourself again and then learn to do your job properly.
But was your workplace facilitating that? Was the empathy towards your situation?
It was a real mixture.
Was it?
It was a real mixture. Like I say, people don't know what they don't know. People always, I think, want to do the right thing. But whether that actually translates into doing the right thing is a different question. And then the separate question off the back of that is doing the right thing for who?
Yeah.
Because, like I say, they've got commitments and things they need to do. Whereas if you can't meet that expectation, they might have an issue with it.
And, you know, Everest is one thing. You know, the metaphorical Everest is there, which was that's where the purpose and the meaning was driving towards. That was Mandy's purpose. Get up, get down.
Yeah.
When did that then translate into, and the power button has obviously filled a big gap as well. When did, and I'm focusing on work because it's an issue that a lot of people face. My mum really was impacted by work when she got cancer and now she cannot work and it really impacted her. Your ability to be able to go back to work now, a fast forward is, I'm going to bring us back as well, but your ability to go back to work and have that purpose before relapse and kind of in between treatment, was that a big deal? Because you write policy now.
Yeah, I mean, I worked all the way through. So after I did my stem cell transplant, the first one, I then did 2 years of monotherapy, which is just a maintenance chemotherapy dose, so once every 2 weeks. And I worked through that too. So I'd go into chemo on a Friday in the afternoon and then go back to work afterwards. So it wasn't an issue at all. So work in the morning, nip out to UCLH, which is just across the road, get stabbed, as I call it, and then go back to work. No issue at all. And I worked through my radiotherapy as well. So I've not had very much time off in the big scheme of things for what is a cancer, you know, a very difficult to treat cancer and a very violent cancer. You know, I've got a very aggressive cancer.
So what's the official name of the cancer?
So multiple myeloma.
Yeah.
But I've presented in my kidney and in my knee, and to have something outside of a bony area is unusual. And then to also have something in a knee is unusual. As I said before, it's normally a spine and ribs that it starts to present.
Okay. And excuse my ignorance on it, but that is that blood?
Like, so it's in the bone marrow. Yeah, so very similar.
Okay.
Similar.
Yeah, a friend, when I was nine, he got leukemia. Died when he was 12. It was a real, think about it now, just a little kid. And that drove me in my early adult life to kind of raise funds for children with leukemia. And then volunteer with kids with life limited and serious illness. And then my mum having cancer as well, and her husband died of I think a myeloma as well, and that's just me.
Yeah.
This affects so many people within our community, whether it's the military, whether it's our family. You relapsed in August 18. Let's take us to that. And what do we mean by relapse?
Okay, so I suppose it's I got what I asked for, really, in some ways. So after I finished the 2 years of monotherapy, we thought that would be me clear for a couple of years and I wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. The consultant said to me, you know, we should think about having a scan just to make sure that everything's okay. And I just flippantly said, if cancer is able to survive what it's had over the last, you know, two plus years at that point, then good luck to it. Mm. I think sadly it was listening, because a month later I was on a train to Scotland to go to a party, and I just got up out of my seat and I felt pain in my knee, and I just thought, crap, that's cancer pain. So I knew at that point on my way up to Aberdeenshire that cancer had come back.
Mm.
So all credit to the NHS and UCLH. I called them up on Monday morning. This was on Friday afternoon, late evening, when I discovered this pain. I called them up on the Monday and said, I've got these types of symptoms. Can I get in for a scan, please? They organised it the next day and I had the results by Thursday. So it was super quick. They were really, really efficient, but one of the things I think pick up on a point before is just people don't tell you what's going on. They dress up language. So no one actually used the word relapse when I had relapsed. They said, yeah, we're going to take you back into treatment. We're going to do this and this.
We don't want bullshit.
Well, no, we don't want bullshit. We want clear language that we can understand. And he gave me this treatment regime, started filling out the form, and I said, hang on a second. I've had over 2.5 years of X drug and you want to give it back to me? Surely we don't, you know, surely by now we think it doesn't actually work. At which point he said, well, actually, that's a good point. Well, thanks very much. So now I have to play consultant to my own health because you haven't bothered to read my notes.
Mm.
Then he gave me a different treatment regime, which he didn't have time to think about, to look at what was going on in my own body, to work out what might be the right regime for me. So I had to sign to do the next best thing, and off I went.
Yeah, I mean, that's... just jumping in there, the importance of actually not always settling for what a consultant or a doctor tells you, questioning something. We can politely question... If you're not certain, or you think something could be done, or ask why it's being done, is that something you've seen?
I do it all the time. I'm a real thorn for this, and a positive thorn for this. So, for example, the fertility issue, I didn't want children at the time, and I was single at the time, so that it wasn't in my intent or even thinking about it. It's too much having too much fun. And a friend said to me, you need to think about fertility. So it wasn't even a doctor. It was a friend that said to me, you need to think about fertility. And when I spoke to the consultant about it, she was horrified. What do you mean you want to think about fertility? You've got a really serious condition. We need to get on top of it. But thankfully, my professor said, give her one month's go. And they were able to harvest 14 eggs.
Eggs, that's brilliant.
In that time, which is incredible. And again, the NHS.
A the quality of the eggs.
They were good quality eggs,
And that's after chemo.
So this is before the chemo.
Oh, sort of brilliant. Yeah, so before
we
chemotherapy.
Did it before all of that, yeah.
You then, what's it called, down reg or whatever, and then you take.
Then, yeah, so basically, it was a case of challenging the consultant who said, you know, absolutely not, you're barking mad.
Yeah.
To have that professor's view who said, yes, we'll give you 1 month's crack. And to be fair, the NHS were incredible. They fast-tracked me through everything. I was literally full of needles, full of drugs, mixing my own stuff and potions and and getting these eggs at the end of the month. It was wonderful. And Mel over at the Garrett, it was just phenomenal lady.
IVF except the implants.
They did it all without the funding being in place as well. So they're willing to take the risk on the funding coming into place after they started all this process and procedure. So they were fantastic. But that was my first challenge to them. My second one was when it came down to the original treatment, they wanted to do radiotherapy to my leg. And I said, you know, what are the side effects of this? And they said, it will destroy your leg. And I said, well, characterise, destroy, and said, you'll have no function. I said, hey, I'm a soldier in the British Army. I can't afford to have no function in my leg. I'm a soldier. I need to have function in my leg, so find a different route. So they went off, they gave me a different route. So that was another challenge. And then the third challenge was again after relapse, where they weren't to give me treatment, which clearly did not work. So yeah, I think as a patient, you've absolutely got to take ownership because no one else is going to do it for you. You're one patient of many. And it's not a criticism of a particular consultant. It's the fact that it's a very, very busy NHS.
Yeah.
And no one knows you like you. So be your own ambassador, I think.
Yeah, I think we one thing I've learned in various bits and pieces I've gone over the years, and not on the level of as you at all, but the guys who I've spoke with on this podcast and friends, is to question. And I think it's a extremely valuable snippet of information you've just given there, because, like you said, no one knows you better than you. And which leads us, you know, that second stem cell transplant, so recent. Mentally, how did you prepare? I mean, we just touched on it a second ago, but did you actually do anything, as in meditation, mindfulness? Was there anything, how did you prepare psychologically?
I use self-talk. Yeah, I will self-talk myself. Self-talk myself through things. I will talk myself through things. I will rationalise and get to a point where I can make peace with something.
Yeah.
And I will think of everything that I can do in my power to make that journey as palatable as possible. So, for example, I chose to work from home for the first couple of months before the stem cell transplant because my neutrophil counts, my immune system would be nil and then low, and it was coughs and cold season. So the last thing I wanted to do was put myself into an environment where I was more susceptible, or when I was more susceptible to coughs and colds. So what I could do is look at my preventative health strategy and take myself out of any environments where I could get bugs. And part of that was there was no bars, restaurants, cinema, theatre, seeing friends, podcasts, because we had to cancel a couple of times.
Yeah.
We had to cancel a couple of times. Not seeing anyone at all. And I really put myself in lockdown because I didn't want to be in anything but the best possible shape for where I was at that point in time and where I was going.
Mm.
Because treatment is wound tight. For me, it's wound tight because I want to know broadly when I'm doing things so I can plan life. I don't like things happening to me, so I like to influence what I'm going to do. So another thing that I'm sure my consultants love me for is I will have them, you know, planning things out in detail and the staff planning things out in detail because I want to be able to shape what is happening to me.
Yeah.
I don't want to be hostage to somebody else's plans or stuff outside of my control because cancer's got control of so many things already.
There's one thing that you take control of quite a lot, and that's impacting other people. Certainly the intention, and now like with writing policy for those that have life limiting illness within the military, but on social media as well, I find you not to blow smoke up your ass, but a real shining light on social media and really positive, but brutally honest. I think there's an honesty that comes through with that as well. What's the future? What's the short, medium, long-term future for Mandy?
So I have a donor stem cell transplant in May. So thank you very much to my 20-year-old Mel, who I won't know who he is until a year's time. So that happens in May. If that works, then I have a chance of a quantity of life. The quality, I don't know yet, but a quantity of life.
Okay.
And that could be a reasonable period, as in get to 50, 60 or something like that. If I don't, I'm a little bit buggered, is the honest answer. I think I'm now in year four, so I've possibly only got 3 years left, tops. Obviously, you can never say never, but I'm running out of treatment options. There's only so much the body can take. And there's going to be a point where I will make a judgment on whether my quality of life is worth trying to get extra quantity of life.
Mm.
There's no point living if it's shit. You know, I've seen plenty of people in the cancer ward to use my analogy before, being pushed up their mountain, but they don't want to be there, but it's everyone else pushing them up it,
yeah.
and they're jolly miserable.
Yeah.
And there's a time, I think, where people have to be allowed to say, I've had enough of trying to go up the mountain, it's time to go back down and enjoy the time I have.
Yeah. What do you fear now?
What do I fear? I don't think I fear anything. I'd like to outlive my dog. That sounds silly, but he's my child.
Yeah.
You know, so Freddie's 4 and a half now. I'd like to see Freddie grow old.
Yeah.
I don't want to put my parents under any more stress and strain than they've experienced already. And I think I just want to do all I can with what I've got, you know, for the benefit of other people. And I think being honest is a huge part of that, because I do look at cancer very, very positively. I do see it as a good thing, and I wouldn't change cancer for me, for the world. You know, sometimes it would be nice if it wasn't as severe as it was or is. But the cards I've been dealt are the cards I've been dealt. So what I can do is crack on, turn to the right a bit, and make the best out of what I've got. And I'm a real opportunist. So if I can help others in their journey, you know, but if they're diagnosed or a carer or a friend who just wants to know a little bit more, then I've done my job. So I just want to do my job as a human being before I check out.
You mentioned the book earlier on. Is the how far are we away from that?
Well, I've had new content to write over the last 6 months.
Yeah.
So I ended up ripping out about a lot of the front end, actually, about growing up and stuff, because I didn't want it, the purpose of the book, to be lost in 50-odd pages of stuff beforehand. You know, so I'll insert a bit about me growing up, you know, into the book at different places. But I really wanted to focus on the here and now. So I'm now writing the last 6 months, so basically since relapse to here, and then we'll have the next transplant to cover off, and hopefully it can end on a positive note.
Yeah. Don't aim for perfection as well. Let's we need it out there. We need it out. It'd be is there a working title, or are we keeping quiet about anything like that?
Oh, I'd always be interested in people's views on this. At the moment, I think I'm almost calling it just Cancer Warrior Diaries, because I think that's what I'm known as, and it is almost a diary or a journal of what I've been through, in hopefully a way that will inspire other people and help other people in their journeys, either by saying, oh gosh, I recognise that within myself, or these things have happened, now I understand them better.
Yeah.
Because when I gave my first draft to my father to read, he came through in tears, and he said, I did not know you went through any of that.
Yeah.
So I hid it all from my parents pretty well, because the first time I learned about how much I'd gone through is when they read about it.
With regards to Armed Forces personnel, serving or former, what's going on with regards to support with the policy you're writing? What's the future of someone like yourself in a situation like yourself? Is it growing? Is the mentality around life limiting serious illness changing in the military? What's the future hold with that?
It is changing. There's a lot of appetite in the MOD to do the best that we can by people who are diagnosed, but also the carers as well, which is important. We now have an Armed Forces Disability Champion, and this is very much in his remit. We now have a network, so the Chronic Conditions and Disability and Defence Network, the CANDID Network, which is there for people diagnosed and for carers as well, or people who want to learn more about it. The policy is going to undertake its second reiteration over the next week, following having feedback from single services and other stakeholders, and hopefully turn it into something which is really meaningful and really, really helpful for those who would benefit from it. And with cancer likely to be 1 in 2 by 2020, if someone's not diagnosed with cancer, they're supporting someone with cancer. So it's a real challenge, up-and-coming challenge for employers across the globe, really.
Yeah.
And the Armed Forces is a big part of that.
Andy, you know, it's amazing speaking to you. I just can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing your story with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we'll leave it there.